Although delayed by the death of Governor Cuomo, Mario Cuomo, his father, may he rest in peace, January is the beginning of Albany's legislative season. Our representatives have returned to town ready to do the work of the people and maybe collect a little graft, too, if they are well-connected. Returning to this classic 1939 movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, it could be Mr. Smith Goes to Albany, for that matter, may remind us of some of the unfinished business in the area of ethics reform from previous years. With the absence of the Moreland Commission, not much reform work is being done right now. But it doesn't mean that ethics reform is a lost cause, though we may be tempted to believe so. I hope you have a certain affinity for lost causes that sets up your affection for Jefferson Smith, the naive boy Rangers leader who gets appointed to replace one of their senators who has just died. The governor picks him to avoid making the choice between the one that the legislators were advocating to be appointed or the one that has been picked by the political machine leader, Jim Taylor. He's the bad guy. Taylor's opposition relents when he thinks that Smith's lack of experience will make him easy to manipulate. How wrong he turns out to be. The conflict of interest around which the movie's plot revolves is the Willet Creek Dam project. Machine leader Jim Taylor has bought up that land in secret where the dam is going to be built, hoping to make a handsome profit. The dam has been folded into a big appropriations bill that has many other pork barrel projects in it. This bill would have passed without notice until Smith decides to make himself useful now that he's been appointed and propose a National Boys Club camp in this exact spot. Once Smith finds out about the dam project, the fireworks begin. Now, in a totalitarian regime, if Smith objected to this kind of graft, he might have been taken out in the back and shot, and that would have been the end of it. Thankfully, we have a sophisticated culture of political dissent that serves as a check against corruption and the abuse of power. Edward Kennedy said, "Integrity is the lifeblood of democracy. Deceit is a poison in its veins." And poison there is aplenty. In the movie, it is portrayed by the Taylor machine that gets fully activated when Smith tries to interfere in the passage of the bill. The land Taylor has bought is falsely described as being sold to Smith through a forged deed. Taylor creates a clever trap to get Smith expelled from the Senate for corruption. Smith sees it too and is ready to give up and go home in disgust. It is only his secretary, Saunders, who convinces him to fight back using a filibuster. Even as he appeals to his constituents from the floor of the Senate, the Taylor machine once again goes into action to prevent people from knowing what is going on, manipulating the news media, and generating public opinion against him. The Taylor machine is masterful in the process, generating 50,000 telegrams in opposition to Smith's filibuster. The machine actually wins. and Smith fails in the arena of politics as usual. The second lost cause in the story is Senator Joe Payne's integrity. His seat was bought and paid for by the Taylor machine 20 years ago when he's first elected. But before that, Smith's father and Payne were allies working together. Their motto was, the only causes worth fighting for were the lost causes, falsely attributed to Clarence Darrow, I might add. Smith's father died for this principle, shot in the back at his desk with his hat on, working to defend a miner's claim. When Smith first finds out about this dam project, he immediately goes to Payne for an explanation. Payne, up to this moment, has been a hero for him, a model politician. The explanation for what he is doing in politics is really interesting. Payne explains that politics is a man's world that requires him to check his ideas at the door the way that you check your galoshes. He explains that real world politicians need to compromise to get things done. He has to go along with some things he finds distasteful. He says, I compromised to serve the people in a thousand ways. I had to play ball. This is how states and empires have been built since time began. Expediency is the way of the world. Payne's conscience does bother him, though, because he has compassion for his friend's son and doesn't want him to get hurt. What stops him from backing out of Taylor's graft scheme in a rise of his integrity is his own ambition to be president that Taylor is promising he'll make happen. So he asks Smith to keep silent as the bill comes up for a vote. Alexander Solzhenitsyn responds, in keeping silent about evil, in burying it so deep within us that no sign of it appears on the surface, we are implanting it, and it will rise up a thousandfold in the future. When we neither punish nor reproach evildoers, we are ripping the foundations of justice from beneath new generations. The foil in the story who throws a monkey wrench into everyone's plans is Saunders, Smith's secretary. Weary of the ways of politics, her heart guarded against idealism and innocence, she despises Smith at first and wants to quit her job. As she puts it, talking to Payne, she came to Washington with blue eyes filled with question marks. Now they are green and filled with dollar signs. She cynically sees how the world works, is disgusted by it, and doesn't want to babysit this clueless junior senator. Any others like that here this morning? It is an unpleasant side effect of following politics around here too closely. Saunders compares Smith to Don Quixote, the mentally unstable character intoxicated in the fictional portrayal of chivalry. Smith's wide-eyed, uncritical love of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, his namesake, he has that same kind of romantic idealism that drives Quixote. But like many cynics, Saunders is attracted to the very qualities in Smith that she disdains. Smith's love of nature and his simple virtue speak to her heart. She swoons. The camera zooms in this soft and gauzy image of her. When he tells her of his father's advice to him to always see life as if you've just come out of a tunnel. His appeal to her heart is far more powerful than going through life all wised up does. When Smith stands to oppose the bill, pain cuts him off at the knees before he has a chance to say anything. Smith is no match for his skillfully crafted and ironic betrayal, accusing him of doing what Taylor has been doing all along. Saunders is the one who stops Smith from leaving town with his tail between his legs. She finds him at the Lincoln Memorial, feeling sorry for himself, bags packed, ready to go home. She challenges him not to quit in a rousing speech, reminding him he came to town with a faith bigger than the machines, bigger than pain or any other living man. She points out he brought what they don't have, plain, decent, everyday, common rightness. Antisthenes, primary disciple of Socrates and grandfather of the Cynics, would recognize Smith. He would say that virtue was an affair of deeds and does not need a store of words or learning. The wise one will be guided in public acts, not by established laws, but by the laws of virtue. It is during his filibuster on the floor he is finally able to demonstrate his virtuous character. We saw a little bit of it just now. To start influencing those other senators. Even when confronted with the overwhelming opposition trumped up by those 50,000 letters and telegrams by the Taylor machine, he can still stand and face pain. And I want to show you that last clip.
I guess this is just another lost cause, Mr. Payne. All you people don't know about lost causes. Mr. Payne does. He said once they were the only causes worth fighting for. And he fought for them once. For the only reason any man ever fights for them. Simple rule. Love thy neighbor. And in this world today full of hatred, a man who knows that one rule has a great trust. You know that rule, Mr. Payne. And I loved you for it just as my father did. And you know that you fight for the lost causes harder than for any others. Yes, you even die for them. Like a man we both knew, Mr. Payne. You think I'm licked? You all think I'm licked. Well, I'm not licked. And I'm going to stay right here and fight for this lost cause. Even if this room gets filled with lies like these. And the tailors and all their armies come marching into this place. Somebody will listen to me.
Can't show you everything, but this is what changes Payne's heart and causes him to confess his evil doing and his evil deeds. So how many and how are we doing today fighting for lost causes? And there are sure many of them out there to fight for. We Unitarian Universalists are pretty good at finding them and line up our support behind them, which can be, unfortunately, a little discouraging sometimes when we advocate for ones that we feel close to our heart, like fighting as we are right now for transgender folks to have their rights protected, for fair redistricting, for ethics reform, for better health and human services, for better wages and employment practices, and a lot of other social issues that match up well with our values. And looking outside Albany, out on the world stage, there are many lost causes out there, too, that call for our attention in just one area, in the area of armaments. For example, which is worse? Drones, robotic killing machines, cluster bombs, landmines, depleted uranium weapons or weapons of mass destruction. They are all present and future problems that are going to kill and maim thousands of people. And few, if any, governments that have them want to give them up. We don't live anymore in the world of machine politics, the Jim Taylors of the world that dominated a lot of the 20th century, but we do continue to live in a world where the news media can be easily manipulated to serve powerful interests. With many of us cloistered in internet echo chambers, talking only to people who agree with us, it's getting harder and harder to hear the other side of the argument. How many of us tune into Fox News or CNN or MSNBC regularly to hear the other side's point of view, to hear their talking points? And when we do talk with those outside of our inner circles, do we talk about those hot issues like gun control, abortion, charter schools, tax policy, personal and social responsibility? And if we are unlikely to talk about those issues, lost causes probably aren't coming up either. Still, sometimes a lost cause does get attention and carry the day. 20 years ago, I would have never believed that we would see as many states with marriage equality as we do have today. Medical marijuana, not during the war on drugs era that started with Nixon in 1971. And I'm still amazed that Cuomo didn't cave on oil and gas for the oil and gas companies for fracking. It's not too late, unfortunately, for that to happen. So what lessons can we take away from Jefferson Smith and his testimonial today? Here are three that I'd like to suggest. Corruption is a fact of existence. Antisthenes believed that virtue could be taught. I'd argue you do need a willing student to learn the lesson. The power of self-interest over public good corrupts politicians regularly. And it's hard to live in the candy factory and not want to take home a little of those sweet rewards. Yes, power corrupts, always has, and always will. That force, when organized in a group like those political machines, can almost be unstoppable, but not completely, especially when it makes mistakes. Go see Selma if you want to see those mistakes. Great movie. And thankfully, humans are very error-prone creatures. Second, personal relationships can facilitate a change of heart. Smith gets appointed in the first place because of his influence on the governor's children. Saunders' faith in Smith inspires him to filibuster and fight rather than run home to his mother. Payne finally breaks down, influenced by Smith's appeal to his relationship with his father, who fought for lost causes. Changing hearts and minds happens best person to person, friend to friend, ally to ally, and with our enemies, who may yet be our friends tomorrow if we treat them with respect. And finally, the appeal to moral values and principle does work. The public good, once clearly defined and broadly embraced, will trump private interest at odds with that good. The public wants virtuous leaders of character to sit in those seats of power. They will throw the bums out, given a choice, if they don't have integrity. Integrity isn't a left or a right, a blue or a red issue. It's one of those right down the middle, a purple issue that we don't need to argue about. Organizations in our society charged with the responsibility to appeal to moral principle are religious organizations like our own. Sometimes we are uniquely positioned to bring a liberal religious voice to bear on social and political issues. This congregation does that, working with other liberally religious groups united under the banner of Interfaith Impact. We also work with Capital Area Against Mass Incarceration and other organizations locally. Nationally, we do it as part of the Standing on the Side of Love campaign. We do it internationally as part of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. And as Bill Schultz, the director of UUSC and former president of the Unitarian Universalist Association and director of Amnesty International puts it, our voices matter and can save lives. Our individual voices matter, but our collective voice matters even more. So as we begin another legislative session, I encourage you to be aware of the opportunities that are coming up to join with our allies to advocate for lost causes. This year, maybe one or two of them will be found. So be it.